The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in today. Let me run through our announcements. I want more time to speak with our guest, Howard Bloom. You can call and talk to Howard, 1-866-687-7223. And no call screeners, let it ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then on our website, thespaceshow.com, you'll find the comprehensive newsletter, and it has the details of all of the programs for the week, the full guest bio, and it's the only place we have a future events section. So do check it out, and if we have to make any changes in our schedule, this is where you're going to see it first. So check it out there, too. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter, and that goes out early Monday morning, California time, via email. If you want that newsletter, please send your request to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then everything we do is archived, and we're approaching 2,000 shows since 2001. And all of them are available on our website. You can easily hear them off of our website, or you can download them. We have a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. But probably the most important button is Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3 with one giantleapfoundation.org. And we only exist because many of you are generous and support us. We thank you very much for that support. You still can get a federal tax deduction for your contribution if you pay federal taxes. The same is true for California. And then also do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you can download the shows and you can share them and pass them around. A 90-minute show is 40 megabytes. If you need help on how to send that to your friends, please let me know. I'll be glad to tell you how I do that. And then we are podcasting. We still thank Andrew over at gigadial.net for the podcasting service, and you can find us in iTunes and Microsoft Zune and a host of other places. If you do have any podcasting questions, let me hear from you. Then finally, remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. Please go to their website for lots more information, www.swfound.org. And do remember that they are the sponsors of our webinar series. We do have a webinar this coming Sunday with Dan Adamo again. The tagline for this one is a notional round trip to the Translunar Libration Point, EML2, that's Earth Moon L2, or what would it be like to set a new maximum altitude record and occupy strategic high ground 60,000 kilometers above the moon's far side. And Dan, for those of you who have heard him on classroom programs, know that these are his expert authority subjects, having come out of NASA as their chief FIDO officer for many, many years. That brings me to today's guest. And as I said a few minutes ago, Howard Bloom is back with us regarding his new book. And his new book, which you can find on Amazon and probably most every reasonable bookstore, The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. And Howard is not only the author of this new book, but the very, very famous books, The Lucifer Principle, Global Brain, The Genius of the Beast. He's been on the faculty at NYU. He has founded the Space Development Steering Committee, member of the Board of Governors of the National Space Society, and the list is on and on and on and on and on. And his full bio is on the website, so you can read it. but it's much more fun, as I always say, to talk with our guest. Howard, welcome back. How are you?
David, it's good to see you.
You can see me?
Well,
cool.
It's good to hear you. It's good to earball you. How's that?
You've gotten new powers since we have last talked.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's start in with your new book, The God Problem. So I guess tell us right off the bat, is this going to be a religious book?
Well, it's not a religious book by any stretch of the imagination. The God Problem brings you into my life situation. It puts you in my shoes. And I discovered at the age of 12 that I was a stone-cold atheist. And but I had discovered something else at the age of 10. At the age of 10, I was one of the most unpopular kids in my hometown, Buffalo, New York. Kids didn't want me anywhere around them. I was a very lonely kid. And one day I was sitting in my great big living room with it was dark. It was a Saturday afternoon. The velvet curtains, for God knows what reason, were always drawn. And a book appeared in my lap, and it was the first time I ever remember seeing it, and it's the last time I ever remember seeing it. And it said the following. It said, the first two rules of science are the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And it gave the example of Galileo. And it told the story of Galileo all wrong, David. It acted as if Galileo was willing to be like Giordano Bruno and go to the stake in order to support his truth, in order to keep proclaiming his truth. Well, years later, I learned that wasn't true. Galileo's, the Pope was a good friend of Galileo's when he was threatened with the Inquisition. The two of them made a deal, and the deal was that Galileo would say that everything he'd ever written was wrong in exchange for the rest of his life under house arrest. But fortunately, this book told me the story all wrong. It said Galileo had true courage and would willingly have died for his truth. And principle number two, the second rule of science, said the book, is look at things right under your nose if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And look at things that you and everybody around you take for granted as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And it gave the example of Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the guy who invented the microscope. So all of a sudden I felt, wow, this is a place where I belong, science. And these two guys, Anton von Leeuwenhoek and Galileo, were in no position to say, oh, no, no, we don't want you anywhere near what we're doing, the way all the kids in Buffalo did, because they were dead. They didn't have that option. At any rate, the point is, at the age of 12, I discovered that I was an atheist and then realized that the big thing right under my nose was everybody believes in God. And if you don't believe in a God, how does a cosmos without a God create itself? So that's the big question. It's not whether there is a God or is not a God. I don't care whether you believe in a God or not. That's your privilege. That's personal belief. If people want militant atheist books, Richard Dawkins will give them all of militant atheism they want. By militant atheism, I mean atheism that says religion is the cause of all the evils in the world and we must exterminate it. No, I'm sorry. mine is a tolerant and pluralistic atheism. But again, there's the big problem for those of us in science. If there is no God, how does a godless cosmos create? If no God said, let there be light, how do we get so much light? If no God parted the heavens and the seas, how did we get heaven, seas, not to mention planets and galaxies and atoms and stars and all the rest? So that's really what this book is after. Big questions, big answers, and answers coming from a point of view you've never really thought of before.
Are you babysitting by chance?
No, no.
Because I'm hearing child's voices in the background.
Oh, no. There's nobody in this room. It is silent as can possibly be.
Well, maybe we have a cross line then.
Well, I heard what sounded like a barking.
No, I didn't hear a barking. I hear little girls' voices.
Should we hang up and call back?
No, it's sporadic and not very often. And
yeah.
Maybe it's God trying to send you a message,
yes.
Howard.
It was the angel. Okay. To us both.
Okay, so what percentage of the? I'd really like to know if there's a percentage. What percentage of our population in the U.S. if you know, or maybe the world, actually believe in a religious God and a religious creation of the universe?
Well, I don't have precise figures, but, you know, the United States has a higher proportion of people who believe that God created the world and God created Adam and Eve and all of that stuff. It's in the 45% range. And we have a higher percentage of people who believe in the creationist view. than we, by a long shot, than we have people who believe in the Darwinian or standard scientific view of things. The Europeans are horrified by this because they have a much higher percentage of people who look at the origin of the universe from a secular scientific point of view, and a much lower percentage of people who look at things from a religious point of view. But one way or the other, you know, us seculars, there are enough of us secular people that when Richard Dawkins brought out his God book, I think it's The God Delusion, he is said to have sold 2 million copies. So there are a lot of people who want to hear an atheist voice. But again, my book is not really about atheism. It's about cosmic creativity and how in the world cosmic creativity occurs, and how we manage to perceive cosmic creativity, how we manage to figure out cosmic creativity. And you probably know this, but the book has five heresies. It has five heresies for a good reason. The book gets us to take a look at something right under our nose, our system of logic. And it tells the story of how that system of logic arose. And once you realize the story of how that logic arose, you realize what a fragile and limited tool our existing logic is and how we have to get beyond it. So the five heresies include A does not equal A. And Aristotle was very, very big on the one thing we can all agree on, he said, is that A equals A. Well, I'm sorry. A frog is not a frog. Two frogs are different frogs. One frog, 1 minute later than the first time that you look at it, is a slightly different frog. I mean, your body and mine from 1 minute to the next are changing dramatically. In 1 minute, we lose a billion postsynaptic receptors. In 1 minute, we lose between 200,000 and a billion red blood cells. In 1 minute, we lose, and I'm not just talking about losing, we swap out. We get new ones. We swap out new cells in our intestinal lining at about the same rate as blood cells. And skin cells, we swap out new ones for old ones constantly, too. You know, there's old Heraclitus, and it's Heraclitus who Aristotle takes on as his bêtoir, as his straw man, in his arguments. But Heraclitus said you can never step into the same river twice. And Heraclitus meant that if you dip your toe into the river at 8:15 and then dip it in again at 8:16, the water you're dipping your toe into looks the same, but it isn't. The water that you dipped your toe into the first time is 3-5 feet downstream. And the water you dipped your toe in the second time is water that was upstream when you dipped your toe in. This is a universe where both Heraclitus and Aristotle are right. There is constant change. Yes, you can say the river Nile is the river Nile is the river Nile. A equals A equals A. And yet, every instant of the river Nile is different. So both Heraclitus and Aristotle was wrong. That's heresy number one. Heresy, and there's lots more to it. I mean, if you type an A on your computer and it shows up on your screen at 9 o'clock in the morning and then type another A at 9:01, your computer screen has gone 17 miles around the core of the Earth. It's gone the Earth has gone 157 miles around the core of the Sun. The Sun has gone 864 miles. This is all in a minute, David. The Sun has gone 864 miles around the core of the galaxy. Those two A's are not even in the same location. They don't start out in the same location in the universe. So things gain their meaning from their position, from their place in a bigger context.
So we're fooled into thinking it's the same thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, look at the word Shakespeare. There are two A's in Shakespeare. The two A's do not sound alike. One is A, one is E. The two A's do not have the same meaning. One is participates in a word shake that means grabbing something with your fist and moving it back and forth. The second A is in spear, and spear is this long thing that you can pick up and shake, the long thing with a point on the end. Those letters are not pronounced the same way. Your tongue is in an entirely different position. Your mind is different when it says each of those words. And the word they both participate in, Shakespeare, has all kinds of social meanings that has taken on over 400 years of time. In other words, context means everything. It's not enough to be an A. Every A is in some context or other. There are probably millions of A's in the works of Shakespeare. Every single one of them plays a different role and helps convey a different meaning and has a different sound. And it's the same with the atoms and molecules of the universe. It's the same with you and me. Context gives us our meaning. So no two A's are alike. then there's 1 + 1 = 2. Well, the heresy is that's not true. Back in 1835, John Stuart Mill, who would later be called by the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy the greatest philosopher of the 19th century, was sitting around with a person that nobody's ever heard of named George Henry Luce, a good friend of his who took on literary projects, scientific projects, philosophical projects, but also was the subject of one of the greatest scandals of the 19th century. We can go into that scandal in a second. But they're sitting around, and they're thinking about the last 50 years, 1835, and they're thinking about the last 50 years of scientific progress. And they're thinking about two guys who managed to go through complex chemical processes and, as a result, extract two gases. And these gases are kept in these things called bell jars. They look like bells, but they're made of glass, so you can see straight through them. Now, both these glasses look absolutely identical. They look just like the air that you and I breathe all the time. And you can stick your finger in them or put your finger through them. You can see straight through them, just like air. Now, here's the trick. But there's a slight difference. If you put a mouse into one of these gases, it dies. If you put a mouse into the other gas, it peps up remarkably, and it will outlive its brethren. And the guy who discovered the gas that peps you up, Priestley thought he was on to one of the biggest entertainment discoveries of all time. Because when he tried the gas himself, the gas that had pepped up a mouse, it pepped him up. So he thought this was going to be his ticket to wealth, selling this new gas. Okay, now let's go back to Aristotle. We got most of our logic, the logic we use today, from Aristotle, and we don't know it. And we've been taking it for granted for 2,300 years without examining it. And that is a big mistake, because our logic is not cutting it these days. Our knowledge is not getting anywhere near the crux of cosmic creativity. And here's what Aristotle said. If you break something down to its elements, and then if you understand how those elements work, and he came up with an interesting metaphor. Now remember, Aristotle was the one who told us in his Posterior Analytics that metaphor is not science. But he resorted to metaphor right away. So he was trying to say, if you break something down to its elements and you understand how those elements work, then you understand everything that those elements ever participate in. Understand the elements of leaves, and you understand a tree. So we've got two gases. By the way, Aristotle, the metaphor Aristotle used was something that Hammurabi had carved in stone, the rules that regulate our lives. We call them laws. So Aristotle took these two words and put them together, break things down to their elements, then discover how they work. Let's call those elementary laws. So we think elementary laws is this phrase deeply embedded in nature. No, it's something we got from Aristotle. Now let's see how Aristotle's logic and elementary laws work. Okay, back to the two gases in a bell jar. You've got two gases in a bell jar, and you happen to have conveniently nearby a two bell jar-sized bell jar. When you add one gas to another gas, well, you understand the properties of a gas. You understand that element. What do you get? One bell jar of gas, another bell jar of gas. What should you get, David? 1 + 1 = 2. Bell jars worth of gas, right?
Or the equal of that, yeah.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's try another little bit of addition here. Let's add in a little heat. So if you've got two bell jars of gas and you add in a little heat, what should you get?
Well, you're going to get more, I would imagine.
A slightly heated two bell jars of gas, right?
Right.
A little bit of expansion. Yeah. Okay, now, David, it's 1835, strike your match, they already have them, put it into the two bell jar-sized bell with these two gases in it, and guess what happens? Not two gases, remaining two gases and getting a little bit warmer, an explosion. What? How in the world do you predict an explosion by knowing the elementary laws of gases? You don't, you can't, and you get something equally weird. You get this form of substance that you can touch with your finger, just like you can touch a tabletop, but your finger will go through it. And it beads up in these little round things, and it rolls off the tabletop and soaks into your pants or your rug or whatever it encounters. It doesn't behave like ordinary matter. It's liquid water, which is very rare in this universe. And how the hell, if Aristotle were right, If it's garbage in, garbage out, which is what Aristotelian logic implies, how do you put in two gases and a little bit of heat and get an explosion. How do you put in two gases and a little bit of heat and get more than just an explosion, a whole new form of matter called a liquid? And if Aristotle's so right that by understanding the elementary properties of a gas, you can understand everything about anything that a gas does, then how in the world do you use the elementary properties to explain what liquid water is? You can't. You can't. Okay. So John Stuart Mill and George Henry Luce are sitting around pondering this problem, and it's 1835, and the two of them conclude that there's something missing in the science of their day. And there's especially something missing in the mathematics of the science of their day, which is at that point all based on Newton. And as amazing as the math is at predicting the movements of heavenly bodies, it seems to be missing out on something major. And the two guys try to come up, John Stuart Mill and George Henry Luce, try to come up with a name for this weird prop, weird whatever it is that science isn't grappling with. And John Stuart Mill comes up with heterotrophic properties, heterotrophic causation. And, of course, that name takes off, right? You hear it every day.
Right.
No. We don't. We never heard of it at all. And his friend George Henry Luce, who will never really quite become famous on his own, George Henry Luce comes up with another name. He calls it emergence. He calls it emergent properties. And the name emergence and emergent properties takes off like a bat. And in the early 1900s and the 1920s, in science, there are whole cults of emergent properties. But the challenge that George Henry Luce, or by the way, George Henry Luce manages, along with a bunch of other people like John Stuart Mill, to convince a woman named Marianne Evans that she should be much more than just a magazine editor, which is what she is. She should try writing her own novels, and she does, but she doesn't want to put them out under a woman's name because she doesn't want them to be regarded as silly. And so she takes on a male nom de plume and calls herself George Eliot. And George Eliot and George Henry Luce live in sin for most of the rest of the 19th century, and it's one of the most famous scandals in Europe. But nonetheless, it's George Henry Luce, the boyfriend of George Eliot, who comes up with the name of Styx. But it's 177 years later, David, and these two guys tossed us a challenge. They said our current math is not adequate to handle emergent properties. How do we get a math that is adequate to manage it? We haven't done it. In 170 years, we've kept our heads buried in the sand. Why? Well, in large part because of heresy number of... So the two gases being added to each other are a perfect demonstration of why 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. Another good demonstration of why 1 plus 1 does not equal 2 is try taking two cups of flour and putting in the oven at 325 degrees for 20 minutes. And what happens? When you pull the pan out, you've got maybe some slightly brown flour, browned and warmed flour. Take two cups of water and put them into the oven at 325 degrees for 20 minutes. And what do you get? Well, half the water boils away, but you still have water. And try taking a package of Fleischmann's yeast and putting it into the oven for 325 degrees at 20 minutes. And what do you get from that? Browned and crumbly and probably spoiled yeast. Now try doing this a slightly different way. Try taking the two cups of water, putting it into the two cups of flour, and adding in the package of Fleischmann's yeast. Then do something. We were talking about how things in heresy number one, A does not equal A.
Right.
What we said is that A's gain their meaning from their context, from their relational properties, how they relate to others. Well, now let's try doing something relational. Let's try continuously changing the context in this mush that we get from the water, the flour, and the yeast. Let's take a rolling pin and roll this stuff out flat, then fold it over on itself, then roll it out flat again, then fold it over on itself, then roll it out flat again. We're not changing the ingredients at all, not a bit. All we're changing is the relationship between those ingredients. So do that for 20 minutes, then throw it in the oven. That same 325 degrees, same 20 minutes that you tried for everything else. Now what happens? It's called bread. And it's radically different from the elementary properties of flour, of water, or of yeast. Again, it's emergent property. And it's 177 years later, and we still haven't come to grips with emergent properties. Now, one of the ways that we put our heads in the sand in science when it comes to emergent properties is through heresy number three. Heresy number three concerns the second law of thermodynamics. According to the second law of thermodynamics, all things tend toward disorder. All things tend toward entropy. Now, that is so violently untrue that it is almost impossible to believe that really intelligent men have ever believed it. And yet I can tell you, all of my intelligent friends in science believe it today. If it were true, then why did we start out with a universe of nothing and get a Big Bang? That isn't a decrease in order. That isn't a decrease in complexity. That's an increase in complexity. How did we go from the spreading sheet of space and time of the Big Bang to the first thing, quarks? That is not a decrease in complexity or order. That's an increase in complexity and order. How did the first quarks gang together in groups of three, making neutrons and protons? Again, a step up in complexity and order. How did we go from neutrons and protons 380,000 years later to the very first atom? One more big step up for complexity. One more giant step for order. And you can trace the whole history of the universe this way. The origin of galaxies, the origin of stars, the origin of 92 or 89 new forms of atoms, which happened in the deaths of stars, and on right up to life itself. And at every stage, you'll see these giant leaps upward. No leaps downwards. The things that look like leaps downward, like the deaths of the first stars, turn out to be leaps upward in disguise. Those stars manufacture 89 new forms of atomic nuclei, 89 new forms of elements. So what in the world are all these scientists that you and I respect, many of them are friends, doing claiming that the universe moves in the opposite direction? Because sometimes when people are entranced by a religion, they're more entranced by the idea than by what's right under their nose. But the obligation of science is the second rule of science. Look at things right under your nose that you and everybody else take for granted, and then proceed from there. And do not accept something as true simply because everybody says it's true.
Howard, so, if you were a science student and you were asked to define the second law of thermodynamics and you just did what you did, you'd get a zero.
That's right. I wouldn't just get a zero. I'd get a very angry professor.
Probably. They'd tell you to go on coast to coast. And
right.
And
so, I'd be called a nut. But the fact is, science as we use it today, based on Aristotelian logic and based on a math that incorporates Aristotelian logic, isn't cutting it. It still can't get a hold of emergent properties. And if you can't get a hold of emergent properties, David, you don't know this universe. Not at all. So heresy number four is that the universe is not as random as we think. It's a lot more rigidly constrained than we think. For example, in the beginning, there's a Big Bang. And a Big Bang is, as I said, an unfurling sheet of space and time moving at astonishing speed. And, okay, if you and I were sitting around at a coffee table at the beginning of the universe, an outdoor cafe table at the beginning of the universe, and you're the wild-eyed visionary, and I'm the old crusty crump, and you said, looking at this unfurling sheet of space and time, Howard, I predict that any 10 to the minus 32nd of a second now, unfurling sheet of space and time, this giant tanker sheet sneezing itself outward, is going to precipitate the way that a rain cloud, a storm cloud, precipitates in drops of rain, and it's going to produce things. And I would say, David, look, we've been sitting around since before there was ever a Big Bang. And I've watched this universe, and we've been sitting around ever since this sheet of space and time has started to expand. And there never have been any such things as things. Why, David, why do you think they call this the nothing? It's the no thing. Get it? There have never been things. There never will be things. Add space and time to space and time. And according to Aristotelian logic, or 1 plus 1 equals 2, what do you get? Space and time. Garbage in, garbage out. Let's be practical. And all of a sudden, the most impractical thing in the world would happen. You'd be right. And I, with my logic, would be wrong. All of a sudden, this sheet of space and time would precipitate into the very first thing. What does this have to do with randomness and the fourth heresy? Everything in the world. Because if this were a random universe, what we were just watching in front of our coffee table is the precipitation of gazillions of quarks, 10 with 87 zeros after it. Things. 10 with 87 zeros after it, things. And if this were a random universe, if this is the six monkeys at six typewriters accidentally typing out the works of Shakespeare, universe, then if there are a gazillion things, there should be a gazillion different kinds of things. And these things should be so different from each other that they have no way of communicating or collaborating. But that's not what happens. you've basically got quarks and leptons, two different kinds of things. And when it comes to the quarks, there are gazillions and gazillions of quarks. But there are only 16 different forms of them. Only 16 different forms in gazillions of so-called random events? That is not randomness, David. That's what we in science call being rigidly constrained, having a very narrow pathway, having choice points, but a very narrow pathway along which to walk. And heresy number five is information theory, the hot new theory of the last 60 years. Information theory is not really about information. In fact, it misses the point. And that's relevant because you see informational processes happening at the very beginning of the universe. For example, those quarks talk to each other. Now, of course, they don't use a language that like ours. They don't have tongues, and they don't breathe, and they don't have brains, and they don't have a consciousness. Nonetheless, they communicate with each other. How? Well, if two quarks are too similar, it's like each quark comes with a little etiquette book. It comes with a book of who to get together with and who to flee. And if two quarks are too similar, they flee each other. They are repulsed by each other. Well, that's communication. Each quark picks up on the other's signal and then interprets it. And how do you tell a quark is interpreting a signal? Because it moves. And it either moves away from something or it moves towards something. It moves away from quarks that are too much like it, and it moves toward quarks that are just the right amount different from it. And the result of this this communicational process between quarks is that you get quark threesomes and quark twosomes. Quarks cannot exist on their own. You get sociality at the very beginning of the universe. It's sociality following rules of communication, even though those rules of communication are simply attract or repel. And as I said, the threesomes turn into either protons or neutrons. Then you get a second law of sociality. Any neutron that doesn't find mates, that doesn't gang up with other elementary particles in its first 10.6 minutes of existence, it's down and out. It falls apart. It collapses into just being a proton and a couple of tiny little particles. So interpreting each other, once upon a time, one of my favorite collaborators of all time, Eshel Ben Jacob, who's the head of the Condensed Matter Physics Department at the University of Tel Aviv and the head of Israel's Society of Physicists, and whose work has been on the cover of the Scientific American, Eshel said, "Howard, look, if you can define what information is, then you'll have the key to the creativity of the cosmos." I'm paraphrasing him, but that's how I interpreted what he was saying to me. And now information is normally interpreted in terms of Claude Shannon's formula for information. And Claude Shannon's formula for information is virtually identical to the formula for, guess what? Entropy. And those two formulae are based on a mathematics that was worked out starting in the 1500s to account for how you should bet when you go to gamble, how you should bet on roulette tables, and how you should bet on dice. That mathematics does not work in thermodynamics, and it does not, or at least doesn't work for emergent properties, and it does not work in information either. So I went back to Eshel after 2 weeks of pondering what information is and said, "Eshel, information is anything that an interpreter can interpret." What in the world did I mean by that? Well, starlight's been falling on the face of this planet for 4.5 billion years, the entire time this planet's been in existence. And was it information when this was a planet, a mere rock? No, nothing on the face of this planet registered that starlight and behaved in different ways depending on how they interpreted the starlight. Then along came the very first life forms 3.85 billion years ago, very rapidly life forms became responsive to light. Cyanobacteria were the basis of most of the life on the face of the Earth, and they did remarkable jobs of interpreting light. How? They took in the light of the sun, and they used it for photosynthesis. They put it through a complex process. Well, that's interpreting something. that's extracting the implications from something. That's behaving after you've picked up something. But was starlight information yet? No, because you don't do photosynthesis with starlight. It's too pale. So these first life forms interpreted sunlight, but they didn't bother to interpret starlight. It's not until humans came along and started astronomy, roughly 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, possibly as much as 6,000 years ago, that someone began to read a message in light. We did it with astronomy and astrology. Was light of the stars information yet? You bet. How could you tell? People were acting on it. When two quarks moved toward each other, how could you tell that they were interpreting each other's signals? Because they moved. When two quarks fled each other, how could you tell that they were interpreting each other's signals? Because they moved. Astronomers started moving in the Middle East, in the Euphrates, the area of Mesopotamia, but in Mesopotamian civilization, people started moving reeds and making little punch marks on wet clay in order to interpret what the starlight was all about and try to tell the king how to make his decisions the next day according to the interpretation of starlight. So was starlight information yet? Yes. Did starlight have to have a sender that was deliberately trying to get across a message in order to become information? No, not at all. Well, how does information theory's definition of information measure up to this definition of information? Doesn't measure up well at all. What? Information theory, everybody accepts it as the basis of all kinds of things. How could you possibly say that it doesn't work? Well, information theory is really about how much information you can squeeze down a copper cable. Claude Shannon, the guy who came up with the idea, was working for Bell Labs in 1948. And Bell Labs gave him an assignment. They had something like 160 million miles of copper cable at the time. And rather than put up a whole lot more copper cable, they wanted to use the copper cable more efficiently. And they asked Claude Shannon to use his brilliant mathematical skills to figure out how to move information more effectively and how to move more signals down those copper wires. And Claude Shannon came up with a formula that helped achieve that. It's a formula that would later help us do compression, data compression, and create MP3s. And as I said, it's the same formula as the formula for entropy, and it's based on the mathematics of gambling at casinos like Monte Carlo. And it works. It works. There was only one small problem. Claude Shannon was looking, his formula starts out with an H, and then it defines what H is. And Claude Shannon was looking for what to call H. And Norbert Wiener, the very famous mathematician and founder of cybernetics, said, call it entropy, because it's the same formula. Well, no, that wasn't good enough. And then a guy named Warren Weaver, who was the head of scientific research for the Rockefeller Foundation, and who had a better brain for PR, said, let's call it information. Okay, that sounds good, right? We don't like to have a mathematical way of dealing with information. But then Weaver and Shannon made this peculiar statement. They said, you must understand that we mean information in a special engineering sense, and we totally exclude meaning. Okay, now, if you had totally excluded meaning from the exchange between two quarks in the beginning of the universe, that means the two quarks would never have moved. They would never have either moved away from each other or toward each other. They wouldn't have moved at all. They wouldn't have responded to each other. Why? Because meaning is how you interpret the information. And if you remove meaning from information, in what sense is it information? It's just a signal moving down a copper cable or a channel of some sort. But it's not information because there's no sender and no receiver. And until there's a receiver that can interpret it, it's not information yet. So at any rate, so we're making a big mistake using this formula for dice and roulette wheels all over the place in a world that is not like a roulette table and is not like a gaming table at Monte Carlo. Not at all. If it were like a gaming table at Monte Carlo, we wouldn't have had just 16 different forms of quarks at the beginning of the cosmos. So those are the five heresies, and they all lead to the same thing. They all lead back to what George Henry Luce and John Stuart Mill were talking about in 1835. How the hell does the cosmos go bumping from one state of existence to the next? How does it go from two gases to an explosion? How does it go from two gases to a liquid? How does it go from a sheet of space and time to quarks How does it go from quarks to neutrons and protons? How does it go from neutrons and protons to atoms? How do atoms go from just being out there alone in the emptiness to whisking together under the influence of this thing nobody has ever known existed in the universe before, because it hasn't shown its head until 380,000 years after the Big Bang? Gravity. And then how do the Great Gravity Crusades proceed? Why do we call them the Great Gravity Crusades? Because matter started competing. Lumps of matter started competing with each other, and the bigger lumps swallowed the smaller lumps. And the result of bigger lumps swallowing smaller lumps was galaxies. And then within those galaxies, stars caught fire and came to life. Well, every one of those is a shocking, surprising move up. Where did these moves up come from? Until science grapples with this, it's not really science yet. It's more like an old one stone toolkit, the toolkit that we had 2.5 million years ago and that we kept for 700,000 years without changing it. Well, it's time for a little change. It's time to look beyond. It's time to look the cosmic creativity in the face. So that's a little tiny bit of what the God problem is all about.
Okay, so you have a couple of questions, okay?
Okay.
So this is from our mutual friend Bob Crone.
Aha!
David and Howard, first I want to tell your listeners how proud we are at Kepler Space Institute that you both are members of the board of editors of our new journal of space philosophy, and Howard, who has been teaching and writing on space for decades, will have an article in the spring 2013 journal issue. We three have been having space fun together for a long time. But Howard, here is my question for you under the umbrella of your God problem, creation and its emergent properties of the universe. How should we space educators change our design of our future research and teaching?
We have to get visual. We really have to get visual. Somebody's got to have a budget somewhere. We don't have any budget. You know, I've been let's tell the audience, all the hidden information here. Bob Crone is really the first person who drew me into the space community. David Livingston is a person who was extremely instrumental in drawing me into the space community. So these are two of my mentors we're talking about. And you guys brought me in, I think, in 2006. And it's been 5 years since then. And it's been extraordinarily frustrating. As we were talking about this a little bit before we went online, I have not been gaining any traction in the United States. The response in the United States has been abysmal. I've been gaining traction in Asia. In Asia. Why? Because the Asians are sunny and optimistic, and they see a whole future ahead of them. And all we see is our past. And all we do is mope around in it. Hey, we've got a future better than the Asians, but only if we choose to grab it by the horns. So right now, when it comes to developing visuals on space, my partners in Malaysia are putting together an event that I conceived 6 years ago. Originally, it was called Space Asia. Now it's called Space Exploration Asia. And they're the first ones to come up with a budget for some pictures. My group and its members were instrumental in bringing Dr. Kalam, Dr. APJ Kalam is the 11th president of India, and we were instrumental in getting Dr. APJ Kalam to address an energy conference in China about his vision, which is harvesting solar power in space and bringing it back to Earth. Well, they loved having him via video the first year that we set it up. The second year, it was advanced to having Dr. Kalam come in person. Now, 3 years ago, I was in China in Chengdu going eyeball to eyeball with the head of the Chinese Academy of Space Technology team that has been studying the possibility, had multi-million dollar grants, and it has been studying the possibility of harvesting solar power in space for 10 years and was about to go for grant renewal. Well, that same head of the Chinese Academy of Space Technology met Dr. Kalam and said, why don't we do a government-to-government project developing space solar power? That kind of traction happens in Asia. It's not happening here. What do we need to do as educators to get kids to look up to the skies? We need to show them pictures of what could be. There are two new companies I just learned about this week. One is a company that is laser beaming energy, which is one of partial solutions to space solar power. Space solar power, harvesting solar power in space and sending to Earth, would actually be done with microwaves, not lasers. But this laser transmission of electricity is an exciting thing. There's a second company I just found about half an hour before we went on air, and actually these are two companies that are building repair vehicles to go up and Go to spent satellites, satellites that are out of fuel, often satellites that are perfectly good and functioning extremely well and were very expensive to put up, are abandoned because they've run out of fuel. So there are two companies working on vehicles to go up, repair satellites that are aging, refuel them, and keep them going for another 5 to 10 years minimum. That's the beginning of getting something accomplished in space. We need pictures of all of these things. We need pictures of what we'll do on the moon, pictures of what we'll do on Mars. And what I've been pushing, the old vision of space is of a space where everybody is anonymous. You know, you can't tell one astronaut from another. Those visors all look the same. Those spacesuits all look the same. And everything is empty and ominous and hostile to life. Well, our job is to take life to space. Our job is to garden the universe. Our job is to green the universe. To date, the grand project of biomass began 3.85 billion years ago with these peculiar kinds of very complex molecules that could seduce dead molecules and bring them into the life process, making them parts of cells, making them parts of DNA. In the beginning, there was less life on this planet than your thumbnail, far less life than your thumbnail. And life's challenge was to kidnap, seduce, and recruit as many dead atoms as possible and turn them into parts of the living process, of the biomass process. And to date, life, we think that life has used up just about everything there is. There are no more resources left on Earth. Well, there are tons of resources left on Earth. For every ounce of biomass today, there are 220 million ounces of untouched stuff, stuff that isn't being currently used as part of the life process. So we have vast resources here, but what this tells us, and we've been through 142 mass extinctions, the challenge of life has always been to expand into as many new niches as you can possibly find, invent new ways to make a living, and then when the next great extinction comes, it may wipe out 80% of you, but 20% will still remain standing in some of these peculiar niches that life has managed to find. Well, the greatest niches for life are above our heads. The greatest niches for life are really, they're in the planets and the moons and in the solar systems beyond ours, but even more than that, they're in the giant tin cans in the sky made of glass and steel that will sit there in the sunlight soaking up all the energy that they ever need and that will have trees, grass, greenery, fields, forests, and farms. Those are O'Neill colonies, the colonies of the real estate that we make. So our job is to take life to the skies, period. What does this have to do with educating kids? This is a vision beyond the vision of that emptiness of space. This is the vision of life terraforming the universe, which is really what life aches to do. And we need to get that vision across. We need new pictures. We need a new equivalent to the program that Wernher von Braun, Willie Ley, and Chesley Bonestell put together in approximately 1948. Somehow they got the budget to get Chesley Bonestell was a guy who created things like the facade of the Chrysler Building, but he really wanted to be a space artist. He really wanted to paint his vision of what space could be. Wernher von Braun was part of the German Rocket Club, who had run across a stroke of good luck. He had been making rockets the size of your arm, basically. And he wasn't going to get to space that way. He really wanted to build big rockets so we get to space. Well, all of a sudden, this little guy who looked like a comedian got into power in Germany and was intent and became intent eventually on bombing London out of existence and figured the best way to do that was with great big rockets. So he gave Wernher von Braun the money to do what Wernher von Braun had always wanted to do, make great big rockets, which is what Werner did. They were called V-2s. And when the war was seemingly about to end, the Russians were closing in on Peenemünde, which is where Wernher von Braun's rocket operations were headquartered, from one direction. The Russians were closing in from one direction, and the Americans were closing in from the other, and Werner had to make up his mind. Did he want to go to Russia, or did he want to go to the United States? Well, most of the people who went to Russia ended up dead. So he sent his brother on a bicycle down to say, I want to see your leader, Eisenhower. Well, his brother on the bicycle ran across a guy from a tank unit who was just a lowly private, and the private could not take him to Eisenhower. But one way or the other, Wernher von Braun ended up in the United States and had a grand space vision. and managed to, I don't know how, get the budget to get Chesley Bonestell, who wanted really to do space art that was so glorious that it changed all of our lives back in the late 40s and early 50s, certainly changed mine. We need a new Chesley Bonestell-style project. We need the budget to do new space art, but not art of space as barrenness and emptiness, art as what we will do when we take ecosystems to space and when we green the universe.
You know, Howard, I think in many ways we've been brainwashed, and I kind of learned this from you when I first met you, because you gave me this speech you gave at Yale one year. Do you remember
right.
this? And, you know, I learned a new dirty word.
What's that?
Sustainability.
Yes. Oh, God.
And you know how many times I use that speech of yours and give it away on the space show. You would be surprised how much demand there is.
Amazing.
For that speech. But people are taught the concept of sustainability, which is 180 degrees away from what you're talking about.
Well, you know, who was I talking to over the weekend? I've been in Boston and Columbia University and down in Washington over the course of the last few days doing bookstore talks. And I was, oh, yes, it was the producer. I was on TV in Washington doing the 7 o'clock news, and they asked me, they said, look, we're going to promote your book like crazy, but would you be willing to discuss several geopolitical issues with us? And I said, yes, I want to do the fiscal cliff, and I want to do the situation in the Middle East. And what I explained to the producer, who's a very, very bright man, was that something that in bloomology is called the caption factor. He who controls the caption controls the picture. So we had a situation in the late 1960s, whenever it was, that the famous photo of Earth rising from a position on the moon was taken.
Right.
You have two different ways to go with the captions to that picture. One way to go was, this is magnificent, we've broken free of the limitations of the Earth, and now all of the universe lies before us. And the other approach was, see how tiny Earth is. See how fragile green is. See how we are living in the limited bubble of spaceship Earth. Well, guess who won the competition?
The latter.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, science is about looking at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before. And one of the things that we don't look at is the caption that we've assumed is the interpretation of that picture. Sorry, there's a radically different interpretation of that picture. And the eco-thinkers, look, eco-think is extremely important. It's been promoted with one of the most astonishing perceptual campaigns, PR campaigns I've ever seen in my lifetime. And it's extremely important because when I first got to New York in 1964, you couldn't wear white. You couldn't wear white because by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be covered with coal soot.
Yeah.
And that meant that your lungs were taking in that coal soot, and particulates of that kind, still. And thanks to eco-thinkers, the air was clean. Thanks to eco-thinkers, the water has been cleaned. That is extremely good. Absolutely necessary. We need eco-think. But any good thing in excess is a poison. And eco-think has gone to the point where it's poisoning us. And the fact is that the eco-thinkers are doing nature a great disservice when they think that all nature wants is this one tiny little planet and don't understand that nature is anxious, always anxious. Nature is imperialistic, colonialistic, and hungry constantly. And all the things nature needs to eat are hovering above our heads. And we are the only creatures on the face of the planet who can take nature that tiny little 8-minute jump outside the gravity well, beyond the gravity well, and can take nature where nature wants to go. Now, you can say nature doesn't want anything. If nature doesn't want anything, why is nature constantly exploring new environments? Why are bacteria 2 miles beneath our feet eating granite and turning it into biomass? Because nature is a lot more clever than we are. And if we don't pick up on the message, we will fail her.
Well, nature has given us in situ development when we go into space. And, you know, it's there for us to take and use.
Yeah.
So, I agree. But that talk of yours was radically changing for me.
Well, so when it goes back to sustainability is like a noose around our neck, and we're always aware of the noose. And the fact is, it's a radical misinterpretation of the resources of this planet and of the resilience of nature. No, we should not poison nature. No, we should not be doing away with species. Yes, we do need species diversity. But we should not stop dreaming high, high, high above our heads. When we do so, well, here's what we're doing. We're not going against nature. We're letting the Chinese and the Indians take over. And that's why you see all of this response to Space Asia, not to similar things here. Well, that's why you see Dr. Kalam of India being welcomed with open arms when it comes to space solar power harvesting ideas in China, but not here. And David, you and I love this civilization. We love it dearly. So does Bob Crone. And we've got, and you know the old Bloomism, civilizations that look up, go up, civilizations that look down, go down. We've got to get this civilization looking up. And graphics, visuals, those are the way to do it.
Howard, let's pause, and we'll take a break because you're way past the halfway point, okay?
Okay.
So everyone stay put. We'll come back hopefully with more of your questions in 3 minutes. The phone number, if you'd like to talk to Howard, is 866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. Howard Bloom is our guest today. We are talking about his new book, The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. You can call and talk to Howard if you would like, 1-866-687-7223. And Howard, the Big Bagel Theory, tell us about it.
Well, okay. I put you in my shoes an awful lot in this book, so you go through all kinds of strange things. And at one point, you're 16 years old. You are working in the world's largest cancer research facility in Buffalo, New York. Now, 16 years old means it's 1959. But when you were 12 years old, your mom took you off to the head of the graduate physics department at the University of Buffalo. Now, this is a little bit crazy. Why would the head of a graduate physics department want to meet with you, a 12-year-old? Give me a break. These guys are busy. Your mom has apparently twisted arms or something like that, and this is probably supposed to be a 5-minute courtesy visit, but it doesn't turn out to be that way. It turns out to be over an hour. Why? Because the hot topic when you're 12 is Big Bang versus steady state theories of the universe, and that's what you end up discussing, the Doppler effect and the Doppler shift and its implications, for over an hour with the head of the graduate physics department. So you're already, you know, you've been into science since you were 10, since you picked up that book that said the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose, the first two rules of science. And you've gotten up to the level of being able to dialogue with the head of the graduate physics department by the time you're 12. By the time you're 16, you're way beyond that. And so there you are, the world's largest cancer research lab, and you get together at lunch with your friends, and then you have these wildly side-reeling discussions that go on until 4 in the morning at somebody's house. And during the summer, what are you particularly working on? Well, there's this little thing in 1959 called the CPT symmetry problem, the charge parity time symmetry problem. Sounds complex, right? Actually, it's really simple. If matter and antimatter are created in equal amounts, and all the mathematics says that they are, and they are created at the same time, then why is there so much matter in this universe and so little antimatter? So you work for the whole summer on this problem, and you come up with this wacky theory. Imagine a bagel. Imagine a bagel with one of those infinitesimally tiny little holes. A bagel in topology, by the way, is called torus. You're working on this as a toroidal model, not necessarily bagel and lox. One way or the other, this bagel has this really anally retentive fuckers, a little tiny hole. And at the instant of the beginning of things, a big bang comes out of the hole of the bagel. It comes out of the hole on the bagel on the bagel's top side. What happens with the bagel's bottom side? Well, an equal and opposite big bang happens, spreading from the hole on the bottom of the bagel. And that's where all the antimatter goes. You have an antimatter universe on the bottom of the bagel and a matter universe on the top of the bagel. Now, what is the shape of a torus? What does the shape of a bagel mean? Well, if it's an Einsteinian space-time manifold, it is a manifold that defines movement. It's a manifold that defines gravity. So coming out of a bagel's hole, things are extremely steep. Curve is very steep. What does a steep curve mean when in Einsteinian space-time manifolds? It means extremely rapid movement. So your bagel predicts that at the beginning of the cosmos, right after the Big Bang, there will be extraordinarily rapid movement. Okay, then once you reach the top of the bagel hump, what happens? Well, that things flatten out. And when things flatten out, that means that, yes, things keep expanding away from each other, but their speed mellows out. Then, once you go over the bagel's hump and you're going toward the outer edge of the bagel, what does that imply? Well, it implies that you're accelerating. And as things get closer to the bagel's outer periphery, the curve gets steeper, which means you keep going faster and faster and faster. Now, why would you go faster and faster and faster when you get over the bagel's hump? Because you run out of the energy. It's like you're a cannonball, and you go through a parabolic arc. And you run out of the energy that carries you upward and are once again grabbed by gravity and are moving downward. Grabbed by gravity? What are you talking about? We have two universes here. This is not like a cannonball on the face of the Earth. Yes, it's more like a cannonball than you think. Why? Because there is a common language that matter and antimatter speak, at least according to your theory, and it's gravity. And once they run out of energy at the bagel's peak, the bagel's hump, the two universes begin to accelerate toward each other, just like Galileo's dropped balls from the Tower of Pisa accelerated second by second by second. They accelerate toward each other because they're calling to each other with their gravitational force. Then what happens? The two universes meet on the very outer edge of the bagel. And what happens with matter and antimatter meet? They annihilate. They annihilate in a burst of energy. And there's a trick in topology to something called the Klein's model. And you apply that kind of topological trick to your bagel. So what you say is that you've got matter and antimatter universe annihilating each other in a big explosion of energy on the outer periphery of the bagel, but due to a topological trick, the outer periphery of the bagel just happens to be the bagel's hole. And so that explosion of matter and energy come out of the bagel's hole once again as a positive big bang on the top and an antimatter big bang on the bottom. Okay, now this is such a simple theory. I mean, David, any questions?
No, not. And I'm on your website where you have the graphic showing it. Listeners, I'll put this in the summary of
okay.
the show.
Okay, all people have to do is look up Big Bagel YouTube, and it's the second item on the Google list.
Okay.
So, okay, now, here's what happens. It's the end of the summer. Your exhilarating sessions with your friends who are much older than you are over. And you go back to school. What do you do about Big Bagel Theory? Well, you assume it's so simple, it can be drawn so simply, that you assume it's comic book science. And you know you're 16 years old. A theory you came up with could possibly be for real? I mean, give me a break. So you toss the theory away. Then in 1980, which is 21 years later, a guy named Alan Guth comes up with a theory of how the Big Bang happened. And it's specifically a theory of the movement after the Big Bang. And Alan Guth's theory, which is called inflation, says that the universe and it spread away from each other at the very beginning of the Big Bang, moved at an unaccountably high speed. Some even say a speed faster than the speed of light, which is tricky because Einstein says you can't do that. Nonetheless, that is validates part of your bagel theory. It validates the implications of the steep curve coming out of the hole of the bagel, but you don't pay any attention. But in 1998, something stranger happens. A guy, an astrophysicist named Adam Riess, and a team of 15 others observing type 1A supernovas, standard candles, come to the conclusion that past a certain point, galaxies begin to accelerate in their movement away from each other. And they accelerate faster and faster and faster. And you know from, imagine putting your foot on the gas of a Porsche, incredible acceleration, right? But it takes that gas to make incredible acceleration. To make incredible acceleration, you need energy. Where is the energy that is accelerating the cosmos coming from? Scientists have no clue. So they come up with a name. I mean, in the same way that you walk into your doctor's office with a stomachache and your doctor can satisfy you by saying, let me take a look at that. Yes. And he feels your stomach a little bit and he says, yes, I think you have gastritis. You know what the doctor has just done?
He's
gastritis means a stomachache in Latin. He's pacified you by coming up with a name. Well, so scientists came up with a pacifier of a name, dark energy. Doesn't explain anything. They also resurrected something Einstein had called his biggest blunder, and you've heard about it all over the place, and it's called the cosmological constant, because the cosmological constant had the mass that would describe such a thing, but it had no explanation. And in 1998, when acceleration is discovered in the universe, and you have a theory that predicted acceleration, you roll it out of mothballs. Why? Because it's the only thing that explains the acceleration. Where is all the acceleration coming from after things go over the bagel hump? From gravity. The gravity attracting the antimatter universe to the matter universe. So you are very apprehensive when it comes time to write the God problem about putting this in your book. It could spoil your book. I mean, you know, people throw nasty snowballs at you when you come up with a theory that claims to cover so much as, you know, it's just a tiny theory. It only covers the beginning, middle, and end of the universe, right? So you are very queasy about putting this in your book. But remember, the truth at any price, including the price of your life, courage is the first rule of science. So you put it in your book. And you also put in all the information that would support it. You put in, there are so many studies that support the Big Bagel theory these days, so many cosmological studies that turn out to be puzzle pieces in supporting the Big Bagel, but it's ridiculous. So you put them in the book, too, and somebody is kind enough, Brian Brandenburg is kind enough to come out of the woodwork and volunteer to animate Big Bagel theory for you, which you are delighted by, and you put it online, and it gets 750,000 hits in 6 weeks. This is ridiculous. So we'll see what impact it has on science. But right now, because it comes from an outsider, it's being taken seriously to the extent that one Nobel Prize winner has endorsed the book. This is marvelous. Martin Bojewald, one of the two leading loop quantum gravity cosmologists, has said that this book is thoroughly mathematical and thoroughly rigorous. And that's despite the fact that James Burke, who is the creator of my favorite television series of all time, Connections, on the BBC and TBS, and The Day the Universe Changed, another terrific series that he did, James Burke says this is the most thrilling cliffhanger of a book he can remember reading. I mean, it's written to just hold you. It's written to just fascinate and entertain you. And it gets across some fairly heretical ideas in the process, and hopefully it jolts the way you're thinking so that you can think in whole new ways. So that's Big Bagel theory, David.
Todd is in San Diego, and he says, Howard, does your book require being a scientist to read, or is it available for the general population to understand?
If I can't absolutely fascinate a 15-year-old with a reasonable mind and glue him or her to her seat, and I have failed in my mission. This book is for anyone who likes an exciting read.
Okay, so you don't have to be a Nobel to
You don't have to know anything.
Well, you need to know what a bagel is.
Yes, and you need to know how to read.
Do you think, Howard, that... Let me put it to you this way, because I wrestle with this all the time. So you've got 750,000 hits, which is really good, especially considering that this is sort of a science and space thing, right?
Right.
There's a little junky pop Korean song on YouTube that has 750,000 hits.
Right.
The disparity is just, I can't account for it.
Right.
Okay, I've watched the little song and dance routine. And I don't know if it says anything, if I'm making too much out of it or not, but I would like to see the ratios reversed.
Well, me too.
How do you get there, and is there a way to use what's in your book to help us get there? I mean, something's really missing in how we communicate.
Well, okay. With regard to all of this, when I was first involved in the space movement, I was put in touch with the people at Boeing because there is a group that puts aside over $1 million a year to do publicity on space, but it is the space industrial military complex that does this. And they have their own interests. They have basically got a $60 billion nipple in their mouth, and they don't want it removed. Even if that nipple kills the space program, they don't care. The nipple these days, though, in those days, it went under the name of the Constellation Program. It was one of those things that George Bush declared he was going to do. He was going to get us to Mars, and then appropriated zero budget for it. And under Mike Griffin, it totally ate almost everything else in the space program, trying to make this giant Ares rocket that, among other people, David Livingston said would never fly because the vibrations alone would tear it to pieces.
Well, which they fixed that, though, so it just, they're not going to spend the money on it. That's
right.
All.
Well, now it's resurrected itself because, again, these people do not want their $60 billion nipple pulled out of their mouth. So it's been resurrected as the SSL, SLS, the Space Launch System, otherwise known to some of us as the Senatorial Launch System. And it is one of the biggest pieces of cork in the sky you've ever seen. The problem with it is, there's a major problem. Now, everybody listening to this knows this stuff better than I do, but let me give you my way of summarizing it. The big problem these days is to get cargo to space costs $10,000 a pound. In the days of the space shuttle, to get humans into space cost $23,000 a pound. These are rough figures. That meant that it cost almost $750 million to get you into space, along with all the equipment needed to sustain you up there. That's an awful lot of money. And what we're doing in space has been best characterized by somebody, Dave, maybe you know who came up with this analogy. I'm not quite sure. But somebody said that we are doing the equivalent of, let's imagine we want to get, that David and I are on the same coast. We're both in New York. We've been having lunch together, and we want to fly out to L.A. together. So we're doing the equivalent of calling up Boeing, getting them to make an entire Boeing 747, getting on the Boeing 747, flying to L.A., and throwing the Boeing 747 away in the Pacific Ocean, and then getting another one made to take us back if we ever want to go back. So how much would a ticket from New York to L.A. cost at that if we did things that way, David?
Do we get air miles with it or not?
No air miles.
More than my credit limit on American Express.
Yes, more than my credit limit on American Express, too. People would not be flying back and forth between the two coasts. I used to shuttle back and forth every single week between L.A. and New York. That would not be possible under this system. And so the task is to get the cost of access to space down from $23,000 a pound for humans and $10,000 a pound for cargo to, well, Elon Musk says he wants to do it at $10 a pound. Well, $10 a pound is far more like the tickets that you and I buy to go from New York to L.A., far more like it, and would change the picture dramatically and would open space to the kind of commercial enterprise that you talked about, David, earlier in the program when you were introducing segment number two, like going to Trinidad or...
wherever we want to go, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It makes space a destination. And it's what makes possible the kind of farming in space, the kind of gardening in space, the kind of ecosysteming in space that I'm calling for. Now, how do we get there? Well, there's only one man in America who seems to be on top of how we get there. And he's not an American. He's one of our many immigrants. He's from South Africa. He's Elon Musk. And some people like what Elon is doing, and some people don't like what Elon is doing. But Elon has already taken the price of getting cargo to space from something like $10,000 a pound to something like $6,000 a pound. If the space industrial military complex had ever pulled off anything equivalent to that, they would be ballyhooing it to the moon and the stars. They've never pulled off anything like that. They work on cost-plus. They work on deliberately expensive. But this is just the beginning, because Elon is now working on not throwing his rockets away, on keeping them, and then turning them around the way you turn around a plane at an airport after it comes in from an L.A. to New York flight. And so he's producing something, he's working on something called the Grasshopper. The Grasshopper will land on its own tail. It will have enough extra fuel to be able to brake and to land on its feet, literally. The Grasshopper has now taken its first two hops and has landed on its feet. The hops have only been, the latest one I think was 20 feet high. But that's a very good start. Now, what's Elon's magic? Apparently, and you know this better than I do, David, but apparently what Elon has done is stop dreaming already and look over the technologies that currently exist. Look at the ones that you can simplify. Look at the ones you can simplify so much that you can mass produce them. And, you know, stop looking at automobiles as what automobiles originally were. Hand-built cars that only the very rich could afford. Start doing it the way Henry Ford did automobiles. Mass production, simplification, making things to be reliable but inexpensive. So Elon, the goal of getting to $10 a pound of space may sound absolutely absurd. It is such a low figure. But the fact is that Elon, in the 6 years or so that he's been doing SpaceX, has achieved every single thing he has set out to achieve. Now, it would be nice if we Americans had an equal degree of faith in the future. But if necessary, our immigrants will take us there. One way or the other, we've got to get the price per pound orbit down. We've got the space launch system. The difficulty with the space launch system is it will be too expensive to fly. It's the figures are very carefully cloaked, but it looks like it's another $23,000 per pound vehicle. And at $23,000 per pound, it will eat everything else in the space budget. And if it flies once a year, it will be a big deal. That's not what we need. We need 20 flights a day.
Be the spruce goose.
Yeah, I love the spruce goose. It's a magnificent machine, but it never flew.
I'm on the record saying that Congress will probably cancel it within 2 or 3 years for economic reasons.
Well, let's hope they cancel it, but let's remember something. It was April 15th of, I'm not sure what year, probably 2009, and I was in Chengdu, China. Buzz Aldrin was somewhere on the East Coast, and I had been working to get... One of the reasons I put Buzz Aldrin together with the 11th president of India, Dr. APJ Kalam, let's give a little background. Dr. APJ Kalam is the former president of India, the 11th president of India. He is a rocket scientist. In India, he's known as the missile man. Well, that doesn't sound too friendly to us, but it really means that he is the man who developed the rockets that got most of the 70 Indian satellites into space. He developed reliable rockets. And Dr. APJ Kalam has two visions. One vision is an air-breathing space plane, you know, the one that's been pursued ever since the days of Ronald Reagan and never quite comes true. And his other is harvesting solar power in space and then bringing it down to Earth. So using Skype, I put Buzz Aldrin together with Dr. APJ Kalam to work on harvesting solar power in space and bringing it down to Earth, which is something that Buzz had helped introduce me to. He introduced me to his friend Hubert Davis. Hugh Davis is the guy who designed the lunar landers, and Hugh is very big on space solar power. God, why was I telling you this story? Okay, because it was April 15th. and I was in Chengdu, and Buzz was on the East Coast. And I had been doing this project with Dr. Kalam in order to get Buzz Aldrin and Dr. Kalam into Barack Obama's office so we could begin to put space back on the map, specifically harvesting solar power in space. And the president, Obama, was about to give a space policy speech down at the Kennedy Center. He was supposed to give it at noon. And I suddenly realized that something like 8 in the morning New York time, God knows what time it was in Chengdu, that all this, we'd done all of this to get to Obama, and we hadn't quite gotten there yet, and we needed to get to him before he made his speech. Because it's in the last hour before you give a speech, the last minute changes are made. So I sent Buzz an email from Chengdu saying, Buzz, we have 7 hours to get to Obama. And I got an email back from Buzz saying, Howard, I'm on Air Force One.
Well, you have the contact.
Yeah, so Buzz had gotten to Obama. But the deal is that Obama went on stage at the Kennedy Center, and he proposed a space program in which $6 billion would be set aside for programs like the program that nourishes Elon Musk. And ever since then, that budget has been under attack. And the very first thing that the space industrial complex people, remember, the space industrial complex have one of the biggest, most effective PR and lobbying budgets I've ever seen, and teams I've ever seen. They are extremely well entrenched. And somehow, in the last few years, the media, the press, has stopped checking stories. It has stopped fact-checking. It has become an ignorant parrot, parroting things that are often vastly untrue. So as soon as Obama made his speech taking money away from the $60 billion pie in the pork in the sky programs of the space industrial complex, the space industrial complex put out the word to all of the press that the president had just announced the end of the space program. And then they proved it. You know how they proved it? Remember how George Bush said he was going to take us to Mars and establish a new space program to get us there? And remember how he failed to fund it? Well, because all the oxygen in the room went to the new space program, the Constellation program, America was going, we were going to take the space shuttle, which is very expensive to operate, out of operation. That would save us some money that could go into this massive rocket to nowhere. And then we were not going to replace it with anything, which meant in Bush's plan was a space gap. In Bush's plan was a minimum of 5 years in which Americans would not have access to space on American property. So guess what? What Buzz calls the Darth Vaders of space, the Space Industrial Complex, PR, and lobbying team said after Obama that he was going to give $6 billion to private space efforts. They proved that Obama was killing space by showing you that we had a five-year space gap. They lied. They lied big time. Everybody in the press that I know, because I deal with a fair amount of press people, you know, I go on, I've been on Coast to Coast, for example, 57 times. One of the people who believed this was my producer, who's a very sharp woman. People didn't check. People didn't check the facts. And this is probably why Buzz calls these people, the people who have the big lobbying budget, space industrial military complex, the Darth Vaders. At any rate, we've got to make the money, that $6 billion is now whittled down to something like $250 million, possibly a bit more. It's somewhere in that range. We have to make sure that money is protected. You know, once upon a time, it was the early 19th century, and America went to war. Now, the experts have been predicting that you would never get a heavier-than-air machine off the ground. I think it was Langley who made one of those predictions. And then along came a bunch of Frenchmen and a South American and the Wright brothers, and they all built heavier-than-air machines that got off the ground. The Wright brothers' unique contribution was not that they built the first heavier-than-air machine to fly. It was that they built the first steerable heavier-than-air machine. All of the machines in France were traveling in a straight line, period. There was no way to steer them. Okay, so we had these flimsy little things, and they were made of wooden frameworks with cloth thrown over them or tightened over them. And World War I arrived. And all of a sudden, the military began to see the possible use of these little mosquito-like planes. So the Wright brothers and a guy named Curtis were hired to make as many of these things as they could. And they did. And that was the beginning of the aerospace industry in the United States. Then came the end of World War One, and nobody needed these things anymore. Did we want to let this nascent industry, this baby industry, die? Well, apparently there were people smart enough in the government to realize that would be a huge mistake. So what did they do? They decided that when you mail something, you could mail it by two different means. You could mail it by the standard land routes that went through railroads, the old technology of the 19th century, or you could get it there fast and with prestige by air mail. And they used government money, post office money, to pay people to fly planes to fly the mail around. And that kept an industry, the aerospace industry, which would have died, the Curtises and the Wrights, it kept them in business. Well, that $6 billion that President Obama was setting aside for people like Elon Musk was designed to do the same kind of thing that airmail had done. It was designed to pay people like Elon to get cargo into space or people into space. And indeed, Elon has delivered his first paying cargo to space. Now, there are people like Keith Henson who are wild dreamers, and Keith has these wonderful ideas about how to get into space much less expensively using laser propulsion. And they're terrific ideas, but they're on the dream board right now. Elon is not on the dream board. Elon's rockets are taking off. Elon's rockets are delivering commercial payloads to space. Elon's Dragon capsule has gone up and come down two times, one time carrying cargo to the International Space Station, both times docking with the International Space Station. Elon's capsule is really built to be man-rated. It is built to carry seven people. Boeing's equivalent capsule, which will cost far more money and will have to launch on a far more expensive rocket. Boeing's capsule only carries something like four people or five people. Elon's will carry seven. Let's pay Elon to get Americans into space. Let's increase the budget from $250 million back to something in the range of the $6 billion that the president was talking about. Let's do what those politicians who were wise enough to start email did in the 1920s to bring a new business to life, because by the 1980s, America had two major export industries. Our socks were being eaten by the Japanese, and all the things we had formerly exported were now being imported from Japan. So we had two big export industries going. One was the entertainment business. We were doing box office business, selling movies and records to people outside the United States. And the other was the aircraft business. We were selling lots and lots of planes to people like the Chinese. We need this nascent industry that Elon is bringing to us. It will get us to the point where we can garden space. It will turn an O'Neill station and an L5 libration point. It will turn that into the next Trinidad. It will turn it into the next Las Vegas. It will turn it into the next place to go and the next place to do all kinds of things we were never able to do on Earth.
How likely do you think this is to happen, given our current economic state and the choices that Congress seems to make?
Well, Elon keeps moving forward, and I'm assured by the experts in this that Elon will continue to move forward with or without government money. And Elon's goal is to get to Mars and to make going to Mars inexpensive, to make it a tourist attraction. So he's going to move ahead no matter what, thank God. Elon's going to save our ass. But it would be better if we could move faster, because people's lifetimes, you know, aren't forever. And the more you can get out of them, the more productivity, if they prove to be remarkable achievers like Elon, hey, he's the guy who saves us. Let's throw the money his way, or at least enough money to make sure that he's able to move at maximum speed and with maximum safety.
Going back to your book for a minute, it's available both as a Kindle and a hardcover, correct?
Right, yes, absolutely.
What about on Barnes & Noble? Is it a Nook format, too?
You know, I haven't looked. I had to work so hard to lobby for the Kindle, and I carry a Kindle with me. Excuse me. That I haven't really looked. I don't know, but I doubt it. I think that it's primarily a paper book and a Kindle. and it seems to be more popular in paper than in Kindle form.
Are you already at work on your next one?
No. You know, once you release a book, there, in my previous book, The Genius of the Beast, The Radical Revision of Capitalism, it says if you have something that you think can save or upgrade humanity, it is your job to sell it. It's your job to promote it. If you don't reach people with it, then you are committing a sin. So once you write a book, you really have to spend a year promoting it to the best of your ability and in order to get it out there. So I was asked to put together a proposal for a next book something like 8 months ago, possibly as long as a year ago, and I haven't done it because this book is it. The God Problem is it. I mean, the God Problem has been called the next paradigm. The God Problem has been called a game changer. A whole bunch of people have called it the next paradigm. Barbara Ehrenreich says if only 10% of what this book says is true, we'll have to radically revise our entire concept of the cosmos. And I'm hoping to give you tools with which to radically revise the kind of logic we use and the tools that we use to analyze the universe around us. I am hoping to give you new ways to perceive, but that's, you know, David, that's always my goal.
Absolutely. By the way, the guy who coined the concept, it was different words about, you know, every time you go to L.A., you'd have to have a new airplane and this and this and this. I first heard of it in G. Harry Stein's book, Halfway to Anywhere. Now, whether he picked it up from somebody else or whether G. Harry Stein, who is no longer with us, actually is the guy who coined that expression.
Well, he did a very, very good job, and we need
perfect, right?
Phrases like that. I probably got it from Dennis Wingo.
Well, yeah, I'm sure Dennis got it from G. Harry Stein.
Right.
We all did, because his book, Halfway to Anywhere, is like one of the Bibles of the commercial space, new space industry.
Wow. Well, it's not a book I know. I should probably read it.
Yeah, you should. It's an exceptional book. I don't know if it's still in print or not, but I'm sure on Amazon, you know, it's available. I'm sure used.
Right.
But it's Halfway to Anywhere, and that's what it's about. If you can get to Leo, you've already incurred most of the cost and the biggest part of the challenges to going anywhere else in space.
Right. Exactly. And that's something that you guys who have educated me have gotten across to me. So this is a great crusade. It's a crusade for the next economy, because economies do very strange things when you open new frontiers.
Are you on a personal book tour? Are you possibly?
Well, I just did those 3 dates that I mentioned. Those were the very first solo bookstore appearances I've ever done in my life, despite the fact that I've been publishing books for 17 years now. And I think I don't know. I think my I think I'm booked on several more dates, but they're all in the same places in Boston, New York, and Washington. I would love to be able to tour the country.
Well, there are great stores that your book would do well in Berkeley, and there's one in my area called Book Passage, and in Los Angeles as well.
Well, these appearances have proven to be remarkable, because generally the conversation begins when people start filing in, which is a half an hour before the event is really supposed to begin.
Right.
And then I give my speech, which is 44 minutes long, and it's a speech that's designed to really radically get you to see things in new ways. And then we start discussing it, and the discussions have gone on, well, until they were thrown out. They went on in Boston until they closed the bookstore down at 10 o'clock at night, so it was 3.5 hours. In New York City at the Columbia University bookstore, they went on until 9 o'clock when I had to head for a train to go to Washington. And in Washington, they just kept going on and on. I mean, one person actually walked me back to the hotel, so we finished talking at 11:30 at night, and we started at 6:30. And then I got an email from him asking if he could meet with me again the next day and continue the conversation. So these have been really exhilarating conversations. If they can be compared to anything, they're like those amazing conversations that you had when you were me at Roswell Park Memorial Cancer Research Institute when you were 16 that led to the Big Bagel Theory. They've been remarkable conversations.
Well, you never know what happens. I have met so many guests on the space show at book tours, at Book Passage and some other stores in the Bay Area. Neil deGrasse Tyson, I met that way. And
wow.
He's on the show now every time he does another book. And Packing for Mars, Mary, what's her name? Just
wait, I know that name. But
Just fabulous. And I got to meet her in person, led to more and more shows. And so I don't know. I think that this format is absolutely perfect for book signing tours. If your publisher will
very
do it.
Expensive.
Yeah, but your publisher should send you.
Yeah, but my publisher's not going to pay. Publishers don't pay for anything unless you're one of their multi-million-dollar book deals.
Well, you should be.
It would be nice.
but, you know, the Korean song is the multi-million person pop culture thing, not science. So.
Right. Well, I do my best. I mean, I try to make it so entertaining that you just can't drop it, and the comments on it are so wonderful. I mean, about how it's thrilling and exhilarating and exalting and all kinds of stuff like that. It's very gratifying when you write something to achieve that, and it actually does seem to achieve that. It's been wonderful to get the feedback that I've been getting from scientists and from literary people.
Howard, do you have a concluding comment, a pearl of wisdom you would like to leave with us?
Keep looking up. Keep looking at space. Make the vision. Make your vision as tangible as possible, so people can feel, taste, and touch it in their minds and their imaginations wherever you can. Whenever you find an illustrator who has the kind of vision that might contribute to this effort, send him or her to me directly at HowlFloom, H-O-W-L, as in Howling at the Moon, or Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl. Howl Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, at AOL.com. And read my book and tell me what you think.
Okay.
You tell me what you think.
Okay, and I'll make sure they have all the links to it and to the reviews as well on the archive summary when I archive it. Absolutely.
David is one of the great sources of life force in my life.
I'm assuming you came through Sandy, okay?
Yes. We had no problems. We had electricity. We had Wi-Fi. And I was supposed to give a lecture that night to the cable television, public access cable television producers. And instead of giving it in person, I gave it electronically. In fact, I gave two of them. And then I was on coast to coast giving a report on what was happening in New York City. But it was all a report secondhand because we were locked in the house. The mayor said, do not leave your house and do not, because you will inconvenience or you will actually threaten the lives of the lifesavers, first responders.
Yeah, I heard that. I have a friend that, well, you met her, that was over in the Upper West Side riding it out. So, you know, texting back and forth, and she was lucky. She had power and Wi-Fi and everything all the time as well, too.
Right. Well, we were very lucky.
So, go for it, Howard.
Okay, once upon a time, this is what needs to be done by the space community, and we owe it to the civilization we live in because this civilization is willing its own death right now, and it's time for us to bring it back to life. Once upon a time, there was a guy named Robert Stigwood. He was in the music industry. He was a good friend of Brian Epstein. Brian Epstein is the guy who managed the Beatles. Robert Stigwood tried to outdo Brian Epstein. He managed a group called the Bee Gees. In the 1970s, and 1980s, Robert Stigwood had a weird idea. He wanted to be a filmmaker. Now, look, everybody in the music industry wants to be a filmmaker. It's like the big step up in the entertainment business. But the people in film despise the people in music. And the odds of anyone from the music industry ever moving up to be a filmmaker are almost zero. Stigwood did something, well, here's what he did. He licensed the rights to a story, I think it was from New Yorker, and he signed a star, but it was a big problem with the star he signed. The star was not a star. The star he signed was a secondary category actor in a weekly comedy series on TV. And in those days, no one would pay real money to buy tickets at a box office to see TV actors, they were accustomed to seeing for free at home. So Stigwood was up against two big problems. How do you make the jump from music to film, despite the fact that the film industry doesn't want you? And how in the world do you make a star out of somebody who's just a second-tier TV actor? Here's what Sigwood did. He hired 3 publicity firms, each one with a different specialization. One was very good in trade magazines. One was very good in major consumer magazines. And the third was good at glamour. And he worked those 3 PR firms on his second-rate TV star for a year, solid year, and worked those people very, very hard until they delivered covers for him. Covers, again, on a second-rate TV show. Well, the film property that he was developing was Saturday Night Fever. And the second-tier TV person that he was trying to turn into a film star was John Travolta. Did he succeed?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, that's what we need. We need a budget to have 3 PR firms and have them for a long time. PR campaigns. There were campaigns in which I worked to get a point across for up to 3.5 years before I finally got it across in the days. I mean, one thing to explain to the audience. Yes, I've been in theoretical physics and microbiology since I was 10 years old. Science has been my life. But at one point, when I wanted to understand mass passions and the sort of forces that make history, I took a digression. My whole life had been in science at that point, and I was now in my 20s. And I had 4 grad fellowships to study neurobiology and clinical psychology at some really good schools, including Columbia, which is the one I accepted. But then I ended up not going because I had an opportunity to get into something I knew absolutely nothing about that would be far closer to the mass passions that make history that I wanted to understand. And the field that I was given the opportunity to get into was popular culture. And I ended up founding the biggest PR firm in the music industry and working with Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run DMC, Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, Run DMC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And with one movement after another, because disco was the gay community coming out of the closet. ZZ Top was the Texas culture that eventually took over the White House trying to find its own identity. Heavy metal music was, to a certain extent, the Midwest trying to find an identity. Rap was the music of 2 different subcultures expressing an identity. One of those was an inner-city subculture, and the other was a middle-class black and white culture that found that this music gave it a voice. So I was written up in 20 pages in the Billboard Guide to Music Publicity, and was responsible for innovations in how you do PR, and PR is what we are missing. But PR takes a budget, and sometimes I would work for 3.5 years to get one point across. And then eventually people would run up to me and grab me by the elbows and say, you were right, you were right, you were right. So you need not just a PR budget for 6 months and not just a PR budget for a year, you need a PR budget for 4 years and beyond. The Darth Vaders of the aerospace business, the guys who managed to manipulate the press into thinking that Obama had just destroyed America's space program when, in fact, Obama was giving it new life, a new life that many of us in the space community cheered, they were able to do that because they've had decades of publicity and lobbying. And so when they turn on the tap, they can turn it on in seconds. That's what we need.
Okay. Welcome back, Cotter. That's where he came from.
Welcome back, Cotter, exactly. And he didn't even have a starring role. He had a B-roll.
Yeah, it was a B-roll. Yeah, just one of the students in the class.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Howard.
Okay, David, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you.
And I will see you again and talk to you again, I hope.
Absolutely.
Soon.
Absolutely soon. Thank you very much. And again, listener, tomorrow night, Tuesday, our regular space show program, Dr. Edie Weeks and her book, check it out in our newsletter. Thank you all. Goodbye from Howard Bloom, as well as the space show.